Almost all the women in Iceland are on strike today. It's National Women's Day there, and the women are refusing to work in even their own homes.
If women don't work, everything collapses.
We are going to show them that we can stop this society.
The man thought it was ridiculous. Oh, you are so silly.
Goodbye.
The beds were not made, dishes not washed, the telephone system went dead, theaters did not open, most of the schools were closed.
Well, it didn't come to blows, but we got very harsh words, mostly from men.
They were thought to be destroying the role of the housewife and putting society on its head.
It's like a revolution, you know.
I saw the flags coming up, and it was beautiful.
The men, they called it the Long Friday.
Joining us on Moving Radio today is director Pamela Hogan. She is responsible for the film The Day Iceland Stood Still. It's featured as part of Northwest Fest on Sunday, May 12th at 2 p.m. You can check out the screening of it. But it's not just Pamela who's responsible for the film. It's also kind of a co-production, if you will, with the producing partner, Heropa Gunnarsdóttir. And if you're out there, Heropa, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that in some way, but you've got a beautiful Icelandic name. Pamela, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Christian. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. This would be another one of those films that I end up running into at a festival like Northwest Fest, where it tells me about something that I feel horrible that I had no idea it happened. So we'll get into that. This revelation to me that one day in 1975, 90% of Icelandic women just decided to strike from work, from household duties, and from childcare is an incredible thing that happens. A groundswell like that pre-social media is pretty amazing. So why don't you let the audience know about this film, The Day Iceland Stood Still, and how it follows this moment?
Well, you're not the only one who doesn't know about it. Unbelievably, the story has never been told. And when I discovered it in the Lonely Planet Guide to Iceland on a family trip to Iceland over 7 years ago, my head exploded. I thought, how do you get 9 women out of 10 anywhere to do the same thing at the same time? And not only did they do it, but they started a revolution that day that has catapulted Iceland to be number one in gender equality today. So they really are an inspiration for the whole world. My collaborator, Hrappa, and I kind of think of this as the story of ordinary women who manage to do the unimaginable. And I can't tell you how fascinating it was over these 7 years to learn all the richness of how what their strategy was, how they managed to get the word out, and how they managed to find a way to do it that even women who were maybe working in a fish plant and not at all political, or out in the countryside on a sheep farm or a housewife, even those women who didn't maybe think of themselves as feminists wanted to join in and say, on this day, we will show that this country cannot operate. It just can't do anything if we stop doing what women do.
So give us a little peek into, you know, what you deal with in the documentary of how does a grassroots movement like this start to happen? Because clearly this isn't just an isolated issue in Iceland. In a lot of ways, it started to become a global issue in many countries. And you saw parallel things in North America. But what started to happen in Iceland that changed and got the word out about this so quickly?
Well, as you say, in Iceland in the early 70s, the feminist movement was starting. In Iceland, it was called the Red Stockings. Women there were aware that they were being paid less than men. They weren't even allowed to apply for jobs, certain jobs. Only men could apply for those jobs. Their name couldn't be on the door of their house, on the doorbell, man's name. Name couldn't be in the phone book. They were aware of all these things, and they were reading all the same things that women in other countries are reading. Feminist Mystique by Betty Friedan. They were aware of the movements in the United States, and they were hyper aware of the movements in Scandinavia, of course, which is closer to them and their culture, and that the women in Iceland were falling behind, that these feminist movements, particularly in Scandinavia, were kind of leaping ahead and creating a national conversation. And so this group, the Red Stockings, formed, and these were really radical feminists who just wanted the change and in their country that, that women in other countries wanted. They did it in a slightly different way. They actually used humor strategically to open people's ears to their message. And I do find that fascinating. It also makes the film kind of fun because they were very playful in the ways that they found to make a point about how ridiculous certain things were. For example, you know, they didn't think that women should be judged by their looks or the shape of their body. And so they didn't like these, you know, beauty contests, which were held all over Iceland. And a group of the Red Stockings were in a small village one day, I think it was a Friday, and they were, you know, talking with labor, women in labor unions there about equal pay for equal work and so forth. And then somebody said, you know, at the community hall tonight, there's going to be a beauty contest. And so they started talking amongst themselves and saying, you know what? Maybe, you know, they had this idea for a prank and it literally came up spur of the moment. Someone said, I know a farmer and he's got this beautiful cow. What if we bring the cow to the community center as a way of saying to people, this is like a livestock competition, you know, measuring a woman here and there, like we measure the cow and then we decide who comes number one. So they basically shut down the contest that night. People started talking and for 10 years, Iceland didn't have any beauty contests. So that's one of the ways that they got their message out is by doing stunts that would get people thinking, you know, and as one of the women in the film says, you know, the Red Stockings would say things you'd kind of go, ooh, you know, it sounded so crazy. But then she said, you know, you'd be going to bed that night and you'd say, I'm thinking of, hey, you know, it's kind of stayed with me. Yeah, things shouldn't be this way. So that was one of the ways that the feminist movement started getting the conversation going. But the way that this day happened was that the UN identified 1975 as the International Women's Year, and they kind of challenged feminists in every country to do something that day to recognize that this is a moment to push for more equality between women and men. So in Iceland in June, they had a conference. And in this case, the radical feminists were part of it, but so were the conservative women and other women's groups, which were much less radical, and unions and so forth. And it was there that the critical thing happened. The feminists wanted to have a strike on October 24th. And the conservative women said, nice women don't go on strike. That is never happening. Communists do that. And then somebody just emerged from the crowd, stood in front and said, well, gee, I mean, if it's the word strike you don't like, let's just call it a day off. And everybody said, yes, we can agree on that. So I think there's a real message here about compromise. We're not seeing a lot of that right now, certainly in our politics in the United States. But by making that compromise, that was something, a day off was something every single woman in the country could say, yeah, I'll take a day off to show that when I cook, when I clean, when I take care of my children, and when I go to work, what I do is important and is not valued enough.
We're speaking on Moving Radio today with Pamela Hogan, director of the documentary film, The Day Iceland Stood Still. You can see it as part of Northwest Fest on Sunday, May 12th at 2 p.m. And of course, all screenings are happening at the Metro Cinema. We're kind of creeping up on the 50th anniversary of this. So I guess a really important time to do it because the further away you get from it, obviously, the less people might be around or the less people that were directly involved. But of course, I mean, you can also see, you know, 50 years later, the ripple effect. But let's talk about some of the people involved that you actually were able to speak to about this that are featured in the film. I know it's tough to kind of cover everybody, but, you know, you might have to pick and choose who you want to discuss, Pamela, that you were like, these were the people I needed to talk to.
The 50th anniversary is important, not only because we were, as you kind of imply, racing against time to be able to talk with these women while they're still here and vigorous and have these vivid memories, but also because as the decades go by, younger Icelandic women don't necessarily realize that this is was something transformative. I talked to a 40-year-old Icelandic journalist recently, and she said, I didn't know until I saw your film that I'm standing on their shoulders. She said, when I was a little girl, I thought I could be a boat captain. I thought it could be anything. But those women in your film in the 1970s were told they couldn't be a boat captain, they couldn't be a lawyer. So she said, I love knowing, and I want my daughters and sons to know we're standing on the shoulders of these women who did something You're asking me to single out individuals, and I will just say something about that, which is, and I'm happy to, because they're all extraordinary, and I'll certainly share a few. But one thing that was characteristic, essential to the women's movement in Iceland in the 1970s, is we're all equal, no leaders. That's very different than the United States, where we had Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and so forth. And so that's just, that is how they did it. And that's why in the making of the film, we make it a collective conversation. We don't do the typical thing of let's focus on two heroines and then everybody else is a Greek chorus. Not at all. We really, it's a group. It's women finishing each other's sentences. So that's just, but let's see, one of the women that was so important, of course, was Vigdís Finnbogadóttir. Now, you meet her in the film as a, you know, you see her as a young woman in the 1970s, and she said, I always knew that I wanted to see the world. And people would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I'd say, I want to be the captain of a ship. And they'd say, no, you can't, because you're a girl. So you meet Vigdís, you see her now, she's in her 80s, beautiful, to follow her dream. You find out at the end of the movie that in fact, 5 years after the strike, she was voted as the world's first democratically elected female president. And she served in that role for 16 years, to the point where little boys thought that they couldn't be president when they grew up, because she served in that role for so long. So she was someone who just needed to be part of the story, because she's so iconic. The minute she was elected, women and little girls started feeling like a ceiling was broken. Maybe I can do something great. And of course, she not only became the captain of a ship, she became the captain of a country. So she was essential. Another woman who I would just hate to have had to make the film without, and we didn't have to, was Þorgerður. And she was working on a farm in the 1970s, and she and her husband were running a sheep farm, and they had three children. She was doing all the work that everyone, all the men were doing. But women were not allowed to join the farm association unless you were a widow. Sometimes if the husband died and the woman was now running the farm alone, they would, you know, allow that woman into the farmers association. And she's very strong-willed. She's very funny. And she said, so I had a point there to tell them, do I have to kill my husband to be part of the farmers association? And what she actually did was, she just took it on herself way out there in a sheep farm, far, far from Reykjavik, where most of the activism was happening. She just quietly went from farmhouse to farmhouse and recorded the number of hours that female farmers were working. She just started keeping a list, because the government was not subsidizing the women in the way they were the men. And then one day, some of the Red Stockings activists heard about her, flew out to where she was, took this information, interviewed her, and published it in Reykjavik, in the newspapers. And this started an initiative for female farmers to be fully recognized. And in fact, after the strike, the Farmers Association was opened up, and she became one of the first leaders of it, first female leaders. So it was absolutely wonderful having her in the film. I mean, I could go on and on, but you probably have limited time on your radio show.
Well, that is true, but we do love hearing about these women, and it's a good primer for the film. You know, something that you said in there piqued my interest about the idea of how you're kind of breaking that narrative structure, at least the traditional one, of documentary films, where, you know, people think it's like, oh, you just film the life and just slap it all together. Like, I don't know, you could have 150 to 300 hours worth of footage. Like, there's writing that's required for this. There is constantly negotiating what the narrative is, right? You're almost following this improvised story as it goes along. But when you're looking back at, you know, historical events, you would figure there'd be a clear path. We follow this person. Was that difficult for you in not necessarily the filming of it, but maybe more so in that editing process and the writing process of putting this film together, to not have a real central person? Or did you feel like breaking that kind of narrative structure was more liberating for you?
After I had interviewed, you know, 30 of these extraordinary individuals, their voices were resonating so strongly in my mind, and I really never even thought about focusing on one or two, because it was something that they all did together. What was very challenging about our structure was, how do you visualize things that happened in 1970, 71, 1975, you know, those were the days of, you know, black and white, you know, video, which most, actually, we only found one Super 8 footage from one camera. The only video that, you know, people didn't have iPhones. They weren't recording everything they were doing. And, you know, old photographs of women when they were young, but very limited visuals. And the television station, RUV, actually sent crews out the whole day of the strike, and they had lots and lots and lots of footage. Only 15 minutes of that remains, because they, like all television stations at the time, would you know, record over for something else that was happening the next day. Really wasn't till a number of years went by that they realized, oh my God, this was a historic day. I wish we had all that footage. So it's 15 minutes. So what we did was something I'd never done before. We worked with an animator, Joel Orloff, young, brilliant artist, lives in Providence, Rhode Island. He had done a few films for colleagues of mine, and I loved his work. And he immediately got excited about the concept and had so many ideas, and also has a wonderful sense of humor, which is in sync with the women and how they ran their movement. And that is really, that was the biggest challenge, was visualizing so that an audience would be excited. I mean, you could have made a documentary just with the limited archival footage. There'd be a lot more people sitting in chairs and talking to you. It would be a little more like an educational video, maybe something that a college student in gender studies would be required to watch. But we felt really strongly about making an entertaining story, that even if you don't think you care about feminism, if someone brings you to it, you go, oh my God, I'm having so much fun. I'm learning something and I'm enjoying it. And the animation really was what took us over the top for that.
Well, you're right, Pamela. People do love the edutainment, that's for sure. But I mean, it's also, I think, one of the things that I thought about when I was looking into this film too, is that, you know, you feel, and you kind of mentioned it too, that maybe tonally you've created this film to reflect the movement and where these women were at. Did you feel like that was important, or did it just kind of naturally come to you as you went through the process, or were you like, hey, before we even get started on this, because you said it took 7 years, that you're like, we realize that we're going to have this kind of tone, and the animation is even going to reflect that too? Or did you discover that through the process as well?
Through the process, absolutely. I did. When I learned about this, what struck me was, if people know this story, they'll see what that ordinary people can do incredible things if they join hands. And we have such a need for that with everything going on in our world right now, not to mention the fact that in most countries outside of Iceland, you know, feminist movement has stalled, and there's a need to be inspired and to see what a country which is 7 years away from full equality, actually at this point, the government has pledged to, they're the only country to be have broken 90% on all the measures of equality, and they've pledged that in 7 years they will be equal, and the rest of the country by those measures is, the rest of the world will take 130 years. So just think about that. So I suppose I came at it with a very serious, you know, the gravitas of it is what drew me to it. And it was only over the years of interviewing these people, and then in an editing room starting to listen to the interviews of my editor and I cracking up, you know, and then starting to put stories together and just realizing this is who they are. And they used it not only to open other people's ears, they said we gave the people new ears, that's the phrase they used, but they also used it to keep their own spirits up, because they were under attack. I mean, people would stop them on the street. What the hell do you think they're doing? People wrote horrible things about them in the newspapers. I talked to a man whose mother was one of the organizers, and he was the only child in his grade school, I think he was in second grade or so, whose mother was an activist, a feminist. And he said that he was bullied. People would say, oh, your house must be so dirty. I bet your mother can't cook. And they would just, you know, and he felt like he had to sort of stick up for his mother, because she would take him to meetings and he would get to play, and, you know, and he thought it was great, you know. But they were really under attack, and humor became a way for them to sort of keep their own spirits up.
We're speaking on Moving Radio today with Pamela Hogan. We are discussing the documentary film, The Day Iceland Stood Still. You can see it as part of Northwest Fest on Sunday, May 12th at 2 p.m. Heck, that's even Mother's Day over here. So, you know, maybe this is a great feature for mom on an afternoon post brunch. I think it'd be fantastic. And also you can get those tickets at the door quite easily or online ahead of time. For you, Pamela, a large chunk of your career has been through producing. documentaries, and this is the first feature, at least from what I've researched, that you've done at all. So you spent a long time working on this film in particular. What was it? Was it this project itself that made you decide to shift into that position of wanting to direct a feature? Or were you just kind of looking at it as like, I just want to shift gears, period? Was it the project or just maybe directing that inspired you?
I had just finished a 5-part series with two colleagues about women and war, looking at war from a woman's point of view. You know, we had to raise millions of dollars for that. And I directed one of the films about Bosnia, but also executive produced all of them, helped write some of them. So that was a very intense, groundbreaking project that got a lot of attention. And after we really made it, we made it with Abby Disney, who's a big activist and uses films for social change. And so even after we were on PBS and tens of millions of people saw us, we did a rollout campaign. So I was flying all over the world, really showing groups this film. And so at that point, I guess I did want a bit of a break from working full time at PBS, as I had done for many years. And so I started working as an adjunct at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. And it was just then, when I was just taking a little time off, kind of, that I went with my family to Iceland. I don't know how to describe this, because but Werner Herzog, I went to a talk that Werner Herzog, the wonderful filmmaker, gave. And he said, sometimes a story that comes at you is like a burglar who breaks into your house and just starts charging at you. And that is exactly how I felt about the story. As soon as I read about it and realized no one had made this film, and I guess also, Christian, through all my years at public television as a gatekeeper and executive producer, looking at stories that filmmakers all over the world would pitch to me, I realized how seldom people focus on these untold women's stories. There's Bernadette Devlin, the Irish civil rights activist, says, it's not that women are written out of history, it's that they're never written in. So along the way, I've always loved discovering a story about women that's never been told, because then when you tell it, people are so inspired. So that was part of it. I think too, part of it was that I was raised, my sister and I, by a single mom in Boston in the 1970s when all this was happening. And she was a writer, a copywriter for an advertising agency. And she literally discovered one day that she was making half the salary of men with 15 years less experience who were literally hired that day. And she'd been with the company on different accounts doing good work for 15 years. And she became a feminist that day. And she became the first head of Boston's National Organization of Women's chapter. And she was in charge of getting the Equal Rights Amendment through the Massachusetts legislature, which we did, but it never passed nationally. So I saw firsthand my mother's frustration and what she had to face at the office. Recently read her papers. She left them behind to the Schlesinger Library. I actually didn't know until I read those papers how defeated she was on a daily basis by pitching ideas at the ad agency and having people laugh at them. And then a man would pitch it the next week. They would go with the idea and the client would be thrilled because it was a good idea and the client made more money. So I never realized how angry she was at the end of every day. She did a good job of coming home and leaving it behind. But let's put it this way. Partway through production, my director of photography, Helgi, said, Pam, you're making this film for your mother. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. I had never realized that, but I identified with these women and what they went through and how important their movement was.
Well, if you feel like that movement is important or anything about what we've been talking about is, then you should definitely be checking out The Day Iceland Stood Still. Pamela Hogan's been our guest, and you can see her work as well as her partner's work, Herappa Gunnarsdottir, at that screening on Sunday, May 12th, Mother's Day, like we said before, at 2 p.m. Check it out. Tickets at the door. Pamela, if anybody's curious, and maybe they just have too much going on that day, and I know it's a single screening at a documentary film festival, is there any other way that maybe online or through social media where they can kind of catch up a little bit with the film itself and maybe find out more about how they may be able to access it in the future?
Well, it's a great question. Because we're an independent production, we don't really have a big team. So we're just getting to that. Krapa on her has a website on her Kruma Films website. She's got a page for us, but we're going to be launching a Facebook page. You know what I'll do? We're going to be doing that before Mother's Day, and then I'll let you know, and I'll let the festival know, and they can make that information public, how to reach us on our Facebook page.
All right. And you know what? If you're hearing this later on, that crazy Google, it'll probably take you to where you need to go just in case. Pamela, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate you sharing about the film. Appreciate the film and the work that you all did and all the people behind it. I think it's really important, especially those kinds of stories, like you said, that go unnoticed and need to be heard.
Thank you, Christian. I've really enjoyed the conversation. And happy Mother's Day in advance to everyone out there.